Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report. With me, John Iderola. We are under lockdown. I'm John, but who's the we? I am very happy to be joined today on the show once again. Aaron, you're here.
I'm here.
Aaron Ryan.
Can't be anywhere else.
No, where are you going to go? We've got you.
I'm stuck here. I'm locked here. The governor says I can't leave.
So we're super excited to have you here. You know, we've told people previously about your podcast, Hysteria. You're also a writer on literally some of the best comedies on TV. And so it's a dark time. We need your comedy stylings today.
Oh, yeah. No pressure.
No pressure at all.
Tell a joke, comedian. No. Comedians love that. Comedy writers love it when people are like, tell a joke. It's like you meet a gymnast and you were immediately like, do a flip.
Yeah, just do split on something. Come on.
Do some flips.
Be funny now. But anyway, we're going to talk about a lot of news. Not all of it is funny. Some of it kind of humorous. Ben Shapiro might lapse into that territory. Dark humor, to be fair. But very excited to have you here. And to everyone who has already joined us in the chat room, thank you for doing that, including those of you on Twitch, because this is our first episode that is being simultaneously streamed to both YouTube and Twitch, and I think to the app and the website too. Not 100% sure about that. We're experimenting with different platforms. Hopefully it'll be stable. We're going to have to find out together. But if you are already here, as about 1,000 of you are, please hit the like button so that more people know that the stream is going on. You can, of course, hit the bell to be notified of future streams, assuming YouTube is into sending notifications these days. Doesn't always seem that way. And you can interact with both Aaron and myself by sending in super chats, tweeting us at hashtag TDRLive, and commenting as well. And with that, why don't we launch into our first topic? Donald Trump wants you to believe that over the past few weeks, he has started to take this pandemic more seriously, that he understands the virus. But occasionally, he makes clear that that is not necessarily the case. Take a look at this video where he was asked just yesterday, what are we going to do if the virus starts to spread again? Are you worried about that? He's not worried.
Without a vaccine, sir, why do you think the virus will just be gone?
It's going to go. It's going to leave. It's going to be gone. It's going to be eradicated. It might take longer. It might be in smaller sections. It won't be what we had. And we also learned a lot. Again, if you have a flare up in a certain area, if you have I call them burning embers, boom, we put it out. We know how to put it out now.
Okay. So Aaron, are you reassured? If you have embers, boom, we know how to put it out now. So don't worry. I mean, the vaccine might be a year or 18 months away, but you don't have to worry about, a spike in infections again. Boom. Put it out.
Yeah. I mean, the disease might be like every single one of Donald Trump's legal problems and just mysteriously disappear with nothing happening to it. I'm just glad that he's recommending that people use, he's evoking embers instead of something that can be cleaned with bleach, because maybe now people will try to dump water on themselves as opposed to inject bleach into their veins. I think that like Donald Trump is just this carcinogenic version of like completely egomaniacal optimism that just cannot believe news that he does not want to believe. Mm-hmm. And we can't believe him on the, information as it reacts to COVID. He's completely unreliable. He doesn't have a grasp on the science. He doesn't have a grasp on the facts. All he has a grasp on is what he wants to be true. And that's kind of what he's telling us over and over again. And, I'm glad that these clips are in small digestible doses being aired and being circulated. But I think overall, most of what the president says is not helpful for people to hear at this point.
Yeah. And I know that there are people out there who want to be reassured. They're scared. They've been scared for many weeks. And so Absent the context, having a president reassure you that we've got this thing might seem appealing, but it's going to have to be delivered with a little bit more respect for the facts than that. The idea that if this spikes again in the near future, or if, as has been predicted, and even he has acknowledged that in the fall or the winter, it might come back, perhaps in conjunction with the seasonal flu, and that would be probably a disaster. Him just saying, boom, we stamp it out. We're going to just, it's like the embers, boom, we, like that doesn't actually reassure me, because he can't say, he said there, we've learned things. Okay, so what are we applying to future incidents that we've learned? Mm-hmm. What new treatments do we have? How exactly do we stamp it out?
Mm-hmm. How do we see the embers? Right now we're still developing testing capabilities so that we even know where those embers are. This disease is asymptomatic for a lot of people before they, as they're able to spread it. And so we need to have like completely universal testing in order for us to be able to even know where future small outbreaks might happen. So that it's entirely magical thinking that's based on nothing but him wanting to tell people what he thinks they want to hear.
Yeah, and my fear, like when I'm trying to figure out the motive for saying this, and he said it before, so really fast, I'll go back to April 22nd, he had this to say, and if it comes back, though, it won't be coming back in the form that it was. It will be coming back in smaller doses that we can contain. But what the doctor was saying is, Dr. Redfield, and I spoke to him at great length, he was saying, if it should come back together, now you, and I apologize, this is hard to follow, it's his rambling, stream of consciousness, or what passes for consciousness. Now you have a flu, and you have the embers of corona, but in my opinion, from everything I've seen, it can never be like anything that we've witnessed right now. Would you say that's a correct statement? To which Dr. Redfield regrettably said, absolutely, I think. The president cut him off because he can't have a doctor talking. He says, it's nothing like what we're talking, what we've just gone through, we will not go through. You could have some embers of corona and you could have a big flu system. And if they combine, if they come together, it's not great, but we will not go through what we went through for the last 2 months. And the issue with that is, why? Why? What new treatment, what new solution, what new protocols do we have? Testing would be something, but he doesn't seem to care about making sure that we get more testing capacity. So how exactly will it just be stamped out? And if you have the ability to just stamp it out right now, why aren't you doing that right now? So in trying to understand that, my fear is that I think it's part what you just said. He wants to reassure people. He wants people to think that he has a grasp on it. But I think it's combined with the understanding that he clearly has that among his voters, among his base, it does not appear to be the case that any number of deaths is going to cause them to leave him. That we've hit 60,000 now, and they clearly don't care. He's still being defended 100% by right-wing media. And so my fear is that this is setting a precedent for if it comes back, don't worry. Not because we're going to solve it, I just don't want you to worry. It's going to be a disaster, but I don't think that you're going to actually care because you're going to have been inoculated, not against the virus, but against concern. It will have been normalized. Any number of deaths will have been normalized. Mm-hmm. That's my fear.
I mean, I also think he might be trying to play like good cop on this because, we have Governor Gavin Newsom here in California, Governor Cuomo in New York, and some, governors, Governor Whitmer in Michigan, who are instituting these really strict stay-at-home orders, closing parks, doing all these things that are really not fun for residents of those states to go through. Like, I was hearing today that that the governor of California might close state parks. And
yes,
as somebody who likes to hike and is always respecting social distancing when I'm outside, it was just like, oh, dude, come on, But at the same time, after I say, oh, dude, come on, I realize that this is something that is necessary for the eradication or at least the containment of the disease. And I think Donald Trump is maybe trying to play good cop and be like, look, oh, come on, I'm complaining about these orders too. I'm the good guy. I will be the one to let you out of your house. I will be the one to open, Six Flags again. And, he's promising things that he can't deliver, which is kind of in his MO for his entire career and his entire presidency. That's my thought, is that this is a technique for not only for him to say out loud words that he wants to hear and try to will reality into existence that doesn't exist, but also to try to convince enough people that he can somehow change this really, really bad situation we're in, that he can end the lockdowns just by being optimistic or just by being positive about it. And that's just not how medicine works. It's not how viruses work. It's not how any of this works.
Yeah, and look, I guess it would be tough to actually fix the problem, but if you can just get credit for it by getting people to think that in the future you will, that's certainly easier, I guess. And my fear overall is, right now you have, like, Tucker Carlson is doing nightly broadcasts saying the quarantines had no effect, it didn't matter. And Trump is saying, we're not going to go through what we went through. And I don't think he means we're not going to go through more infections. I think he means we're not going to lock down. And I think that that's the 1-2 punch. Start to question whether the quarantines were necessary and start to believe that they'll never come back, so that if it does get bad, he won't face quite as much pressure to lock things down again. And they can just resume normal, you know, economic activity. That seems to be their overriding concern. And I'm worried that that's what they're setting us up for in the future.
Yeah, I don't think you're wrong. And I think this is a very paranoid and worrying time. We're all sitting at home alone with our thoughts. And I definitely have had that thought occur to me as well.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Remember not long ago when we found out that a number of senators had made a number of incredibly suspicious stock sales and purchases as they were getting behind-the-scenes information about the likely spread of coronavirus, and they appeared desperate to ward off economic losses that indeed did come from many people who own stock. Well, we've got more numbers to add on to that story. A new analysis of financial disclosure documents found that Republican and Democratic members of Congress made nearly 1,500 stock transactions worth up to $158 million between February and April as the coronavirus spread across the U.S. This is coming from the Campaign Legal Center, and they said that the stock trading was bipartisan. 27 Democrats, 21 Republicans, and one independent were making trades as the devastation that COVID-19 would exact on the U.S. crystallized. Most congressional members are millionaires, and a number have investments in the tens of millions and are far more likely to have investments in the markets. And specifically, so what sorts of trades? Because it's one thing for them to trade. They're millionaires. They have money. They have stock. In any given couple month period, they're probably going to trade a lot of stock. Here's what makes it a little bit suspicious. So they say that of those transactions, some members of Congress were strategically buying stock in companies that might see a boost during the crisis, as well as selling stocks that seemed likely to tank. Public servants made purchases in remote work technologies, telemedicine companies, and car manufacturers that were shifting their production to ventilators. Sales were made in companies in the restaurant and hospitality industries. So Aaron, I don't think that we've talked since like the Kelly Loeffler and Richard Burr stuff came out. But it looks like that while they might have sold the most in a short period of time, they were hardly alone in trying to either make money during the situation or at least avoid losing tons of money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and seeing this today, okay, so way back in the day during the financial crisis in 2008, I worked in finance. I worked at Merrill Lynch and I had my licenses to be a stockbroker. And one of the questions that I have reading stories about this is, I wonder what the bank reports on these companies said when these people were making these trades. Because if you have a broker and you call them up and you tell them you want to sell stocks that are really highly rated by your company in favor of stocks that are sort of meh, uh-huh. that there's no reason for them to have like a positive analysis of, your broker would give you a little bit of pushback, because even though you have the final say in what you buy and sell in most arrangements, if you're doing something that seems really dumb, your broker would be like, what's going on? If you're a member of Congress, I can imagine that there are some brokers who ask some questions. And I think that reporters who are covering this would be really well served to look into what the ratings of those stocks were at the time of those trades, and then see if maybe some of these Congress people were telling their brokers things that they shouldn't be telling their brokers. I mean, it is not surprising to me that people who act in their own self-interest are acting in their own self-interest in this way. It's especially disgusting because they're profiting off of a pandemic that is hurting millions and millions and millions of people, billions of people worldwide. But I think that this is probably something that's endemic to an entire part of our culture, which is people having access to information that could be useful publicly, but instead using it to profit privately. So, I mean, it's really disgusting, but not surprising. And I hate that I'm that cynical.
You know, that's really interesting what you brought up. That's sort of like, if they had raised concerns when asked to do these trades, is that the sort of thing that there would be any kind of paper trail for traditionally?
I mean, a broker would be really stupid to email about that. I would imagine that they were probably, if conversations happened, if a congressman was stupid enough to talk about how they wanted to do insider trading, they probably wouldn't have done it over something that had a paper trail. And, you know, any conversation would probably have been in person or over the phone. But it just seems like if I were a broker to a member of Congress, and they were all of a sudden calling me and selling all of these stocks that, you know, are for people who go outdoors in life, and buying stocks for people being stuck indoors, I would be like, what do you know that I don't know? You know, and why are you acting in a way that is not in line with what our company is recommending people do? I mean, these are just questions that I have. I don't want to sound like Alex Jones right now, but I think that there's probably a lot more to this story than we know, and I hope people keep looking into it.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, ever since especially the Byrne Loeffler stuff came out, and they said, well, especially Loeffler, she said, I don't control the sales. I mean, the obvious follow-up question is, well, then that's an amazing coincidence that you had the private information, but you didn't act on it, and you didn't share it, but someone else who is in charge of your stocks acted exactly as you would if you had had access to that information. And it seems like it's going to be very difficult to actually prove that it happened, let alone for there to be any consequences, since apparently you're allowed to do that. But it sure does seem interesting. It does seem like a big coincidence.
Well, so, I mean, it sounds like the explanation here is telepathy. And if we do have a congressman with telepathy, then we should be utilizing her in our intel gathering. It'd probably save us a ton of money, and it would probably prevent us from making mistakes. So I think maybe Senator Loeffler should, you know, start applying her skills to figuring out what the enemies of America are doing and stopping civilian harm. That's just me. That's just my opinion.
You're thinking outside of the brain. Are you picking up anything from the leadership of North Korea right now? I don't know. But I would like to, in light of this new information, I would like to re-up a tweet that we had previously used on the show from Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on March 20th, saying members of Congress should not be allowed to own individual stock. We are here to serve the public, not to profiteer. It's shocking that it's even been allowed up to this point. And you can see there that a lot of people tended to agree with that. Actually, I don't know where you stand on this. She sees it as a potential solution to the issue that we saw with profiteering around the pandemic. But of course, I mean, there are any number of different pieces of legislation that hypothetically could be used to inform stock purchases or sales. I'm personally worried that, you know, Steve Mnuchin having so much unilateral control over that multi-trillion dollar slush fund that could be handed to corporations, what's to stop him from investing in a corporation before he gives it a windfall of billions and billions of dollars? Or spreading the information so others can make money off of it. It seems weird that when they have power to influence the success or failure of industries, that they would be able to be invested in those same industries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess it's really hard to make a law that will prevent all of the innovative smash and grabs that happen whenever there's a crisis in this country. It's like, you know, I've said this before and other people have made this comparison, but, you know, every time there's a crisis in a poor neighborhood and people like are stealing bread to feed their family, it's looting. But every time there's a national crisis and rich people are just stealing money from the tax coffers, it's somehow it's a stimulus package. Yeah. And it's really frustrating. I think there, I think the perks of being in Congress should be enough without having to become a millionaire. Like, you have the best healthcare of anybody in the country. Like, you get paid a six-figure salary. You get to work in a beautiful office. Like, you have to deal with your constituents, but that's part of the job. Mm-hmm. Ideally, you can make America a better place. I think during the time that you're in Congress, there needs to be some regulation in the way that you're allowed to behave in the stock market. I'm just not a lawmaker, so I can't write laws. But I do think that starting with, okay, what if they're not allowed to own individual stock? That's a good place to start the conversation. Mm-hmm. And I think the conversation would actually have to probably lead to something a little bit more complicated. But it's completely true. AOC is completely right that what is happening is egregious, and no voter would vote to put somebody in office if they thought that they were going to do this.
Exactly. And supposedly the Trump fans should like this. I mean, after all, they want to drain the swamp. They don't want elites getting rich, you know, by manipulating laws. But obviously, they're not actually pushing for that. Since the beginning of the coronavirus, a number of states have just coincidentally found this to be the perfect time to try to restrict individuals' access to being able to get abortion and other related services in their states. One of the biggest back and forths over the past few weeks has been in Texas, where you have almost on a day-to-day basis been able to, then not been able to, then been able to, then not been able to get access to an abortion at the incredibly limited number of clinics that are allowed to operate there even in normal times. But in addition to Texas, we have 12 other states: Arkansas, Alaska, Mississippi, Tennessee, Utah, Oklahoma, Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky, Alabama, Louisiana, and West Virginia have also attempted to curtail abortion access in some way under coronavirus-related bans. And while at times the Texas moves have been overridden by courts, that is not always the case in other parts of the country. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit said that Arkansas can suspend abortions during the pandemic. In the opinion, a federal judge writes that while medications, abortions using pills may continue, surgical abortions that are not immediately medically necessary are prohibited. So, Aaron, I imagine not probably super surprised that right-wingers are taking this opportunity to accomplish these goals.
I mean, it's another example of people who are craven using a crisis as an excuse for them to push through an agenda that doesn't really have anything to do with the crisis itself. Like, for women who are pregnant and don't want to be, or can't for whatever reason have a child, time is of the essence. And it's like, I feel like that fact is something that literally everybody knows. Pregnancy is progressive, and it's not something that you can just hit pause on because there's a pandemic going on. The fact that I just find it all so inhumane. I don't understand the purpose of doing this. Like, because,
well,
okay,
I think
so,
part
so,
of the purpose so, is they don't want women to ever have an abortion.
Sure. Okay. So let's say that they don't want women to have an abortion, but if you're a woman who's pregnant and doesn't want to be pregnant, you're going to figure out a way to not be pregnant in almost every case. And if you make a woman wait, the longer you wait in a pregnancy, the more complicated, costly, time consuming, and the more downtime you have. So essentially what they're doing is creating a backlog of more complicated procedures that are going to happen either in their own states once a judge overturns what these, you know, dumb laws are trying to accomplish, or in other states. So what is happening is that it is ultimately taking more resources from medicine than it would have been if they just let women take care of their reproductive health when they wanted to. That's the thing that drives me nuts. I'm glad that, to Arkansas's credit, it's the only time I've ever sent starting a sentence that way, to Arkansas's credit, that they're allowing medication abortions to continue. There are some states that are trying to limit that, which is completely nonsensical, because a medication abortion is like, you take one pill at the doctor's office and you take another one when you go home that night. And there's no reason to to prevent people from doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think one of the big differences here, because as you point out, if you want to get it, you're going to be able to get it. It might be more expensive, more inconvenient, more dangerous, perhaps. But it's certainly possible. I think one of the differences is that, like, we can identify policy-based differences along the ideological spectrum, but I think that the willingness or eagerness to just inflict suffering as a punishment is not necessarily evenly distributed across the ideological spectrum. Right. You know, Trump famously said during the 2016 election, he was asked by, I think it was Chris Matthews, oddly enough, but should there be some sort of punishment for women who underwent an abortion? And he said, yeah, they should be punished.
I remember watching that. I'm thinking, like, there should be some form of punishment. Like, mm-hmm. being pregnant when you don't want to be pregnant is punishment enough. Like, mm-hmm. that is, it's not fun. Nobody likes having an abortion. You know, it's not fun for anybody to have a medical procedure. I think that the thing is, like, first of all, to use this oft-used quote, the cruelty is the point. I also find it kind of ironic that, you know, a lot of the people who are trying to prevent women from having abortions are people who identify as Christians, and their New Testament God would be forgiving, and they're acting very Old Testament God-like by trying to punish people and inflict suffering on people that they yeah. believe have somehow not behaved in the way they want them to behave.
Exactly. It's a very hierarchical system, and if you are in one of the lower rungs of that hierarchy, you're kind of asking for it by your very nature, but especially if you transgress against the dictates of those at the top, like you said, the cruelty is the point. That's what they want, and many of their voters want to see it. They want to see, like, for instance, we know statistically drug testing people who get some sort of public benefits or something like that is a waste of money. Very few people do. It's a waste of money. But Republican voters still very much support that because they like the inconvenience being put on the people who get the money. They like the humiliation being put on. These are people that they look down on. And while they might not be doing well economically, it makes them feel good to see someone else being hurt. Mm-hmm. It's unfortunately a very successful strategy in America.
Yeah.
Now, really fast, in response to many of these Republicans saying that these are not necessary procedures, I just want to read a response. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and the American Board of Obstetrics and Gynecology released a statement on March 18th naming abortion, quote, an essential component of comprehensive health care. They write, quote, it is also a time-sensitive service for which a delay of several weeks, or in some cases days, may increase the risks or potentially make it completely inaccessible. For example, in Ohio, where most abortions are banned after 20 weeks, a delay could make illegal abortion nearly impossible. And the acting president for Planned Parenthood said that the impact of these changes can't be understated. There's been over a 700% increase in patients leaving Texas to seek abortion in other states over the last weeks. And the thing is, this is just the most recent slap in the face for women trying to exercise their constitutional rights in Texas. They already had to drive on average in that state 260 miles for at least 4 hours to reach a clinic on average, because in this massive, massive state, there were 23.
Yeah, it's not doing great. I think a lot of people think that just because Roe v. Wade is still technically intact, that women have access to abortion, and that's not the case. And right now, especially during the pandemic, when we're seeing people who are already pushed to the margins, having their options even more limited, I think people who live in maybe some coastal bubbles should get a better sense of just how precarious the right to abortion is for most American women.
Ben Shapiro appeared on the Rubin Report yesterday, and he had a very important message about how willing we should be to reopen society, even if it means that some of the most vulnerable might die as a result.
New York State. Okay, so which is it? I mean, obviously that means that more people are going to be infected. So you were always going to make this public policy consideration. Nobody just wants to say the obvious truth, which is that we're all making actuarial deductions about what are the costs in terms of how many human lives, how many years of life, because that is an actual issue in actuarial tables, right? If somebody who is 81 dies of COVID-19, that is not the same thing as somebody who is 30 dying of COVID-19. I mean, if this were killing children, everyone would be in for lockdown forever. That's the reality, right? If a bunch of five-year-olds were dying of COVID-19, and people were saying, get back to work, I'd be like, nope, I'm not letting my five-year-old die. If grandma right. dies in a nursing home at age 81, that's tragic and it's terrible. Also, life expectancy in the United States is 80. So that is not the same thing. In moral terms, you want to save every life you can. At the same time, to pretend that it is of the same calculation, the age of the person, no public policy acts like that. Not a single public policy in American life acts like that.
So it's a tragedy, but I mean, come on. She already hit 80. Like, what's she hanging around for? She had a good run, Aaron.
I think you just made a great argument in favor of fighting climate change. Like, of course we should be prioritizing the needs of the young. Mm-hmm. If, you know, if a 5-year-old is going to live an entire life on a poisoned planet, then maybe it's fair for us to ask people who are, I don't know, 60-year-old dudes to make some sacrifices, maybe like cut back on their corporate profits a little bit. You know what? I agree with Ben Shapiro on this one. We do need to prioritize the needs of the young. And that's why it's really important that we have a Green New Deal and really, really strict emissions controls to make sure our planet is in great condition for them as they age.
That is very clever. I have a feeling he will not be persuaded by it. Exactly. Yeah. If we really want to safeguard their health, I can make some suggestions as well. I don't think that that's what he's really thinking about. And I understand that he's trying to couch his language with, I'm just making actuarial table deductions. Yes, he's poring over the tables. That's what he's doing when he's not broadcasting. No, he's trying to cover for an absolute incompetent moron of a president and governors who want to push to reopen, no matter the cost to grandma or whoever, because they believe that that's a best chance of accomplishing two goals, stimulating the stock market and getting Donald Trump reelected. That's it. I mean, and it's an impressive amount of mental flexibility that they can go one day from pro-life, that they identify as being in favor of life, to arguing that grandma's had a good run. Why are you worrying so much about extending her life? But they were able to do it, if that's what it takes to defend Donald Trump.
Yeah, it's funny because Secretary of Health and Human Services Alex Azar has been, I've heard reports that he referred to HHS as the Department of Life because he's so pro-life. So it is really funny to see how many mental flips and flops they've had to do in order to get here. I also think that, you know, this has really brought into relief a couple truths. I do agree with Ben Shapiro on a couple points. He's right that if 5-year-olds were dying, nobody would leave the house. And he is right that we don't value the elderly in this society. And I think that there's something kind of sick about that, that so many people who are elderly are shoved away into giant group homes and not really experiencing interaction with their families. And part of those reasons are economic, and some of those reasons are just social norms. But the way that I've seen a lot of people show their butts in this moment about how like little they care about the elderly is really exposing something that's like deeply wrong with American society. And it sucks. When I was in high school, I worked at a nursing home, and I don't want to be one of those people that pretends that old people are like angels sent from heaven to teach us lessons, because some of them are jerks just like everybody. But a lot of them have a lot to say. A lot of them are super interesting to talk to and hang out with. A lot of them love to read, and they have a whole accumulated life of knowledge, wisdom, information. And the fact that we're just willing to throw them away, or that anybody's willing to talk about throwing them away, is disgusting.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, like, I guess, why isn't he more concerned about the fact that you have more and more people, including, again, we talked about this on the show yesterday, but Tucker Carlson, he is all aboard the schools should be restarted because kids don't die from this, which is not actually true. Some kids have died from it. In general, they do seem to do better. And so people ranging the gamut from Donald Trump to Tucker Carlson, who believes himself to be a critical thinker, a serious person who will say what's necessary, is like, you know what, just send all the kids back to school because they won't die from this. Except, of course, the principal and the teacher and all of those that they have to be around,
right.
They will be exposed.
And one of those kids has like a parent that is in any way immunocompromised, or somebody who has cancer that's in their life. I mean, the only way that we could reopen schools is if the schools were totally self-regulating, the kids taught each other, and they are on child island together. But as long as they're being exposed to populations that could succumb to COVID, that's a completely irresponsible thing to suggest.
100%. And if you're willing to say, like, we would do anything to stop our kids from dying, why aren't you willing to do even something to stop your kids from inadvertently killing their relatives or spreading it to their parents, who then spread it to someone else? Like, death comes at the end of that, perhaps not for the kid, but others will die. It's such a weird blind spot that these supposedly, like, these people are considered intellectual gladiators, but they can't think a half a step ahead to the fact that one of the main things that kids do as a hobby is spread disease between each other and to other people. That's just what they do. These people have kids. I think Ben Shapiro has kids, but he doesn't understand that that will spread to other people.
Yeah. I think it is a little more magical thinking, though, because I have a lot of friends who are parents, and it's really hard to be home with your kids trying to, some of my friends who are working from home, trying to work from home and then also take care of their kids, it's really, really exhausting. And it might feel nice to hear a really dumb idea that doesn't feel all the way thought through. That's like, what if your kids could go back to school, even though that's not tenable? But it's really, I mean, like, some people that I know have said that, like, oh, it's so exhausting. I feel like I'm on the verge of breaking. I had to take a personal day from work. My kids, you know, they have a kindergartner with like a 4-page lesson plan for the day that I'm supposed to teach, in addition to doing all my regular stuff. My husband isn't helping. Like, it's really stressful to be a parent right now, home with some kids. Yeah. And so imagining a world where they could go back to school and you could get some peace and quiet is kind of nice, even though it's not feasible.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's magical thinking, and it's magical speech. It appeals to dumb people to hear another dumb person who seems kind of smart and talks really fast and is super confident in what they say. You can make a lot of money on the right if you have those characteristics. Chris Hayes woke up this morning to calls trending on Twitter for him to be fired, because yesterday on his show, he talked about the allegations against Joe Biden that have been made by Tara Reid. Here is a section of his coverage to give you an idea of how just sort of straight reporting it actually was.
But part of the difficult lesson of the Me Too era is not that every accusation is true and everything should be believed on its face, but that you do have to fight yourself when you feel that impulse. You have to do that in order to take seriously what is being alleged and what the evidence is, and to evaluate it. And that is the case with the accusation by a woman named Tara Reid against Joe Biden. A spokeswoman for Joe Biden says the allegation is false, and they have strongly denied it. This week, there was also a new development in the story, and that is that Tara Reid's former neighbor at the time went on the record with her name telling Business Insider that in 1995 or 1996, a few years after this, that Reid told her she had been assaulted by Biden.
Okay, so look, he goes on for longer. He talks with Rebecca Traister and all that. But the thing about it is that there are literally calls for him to be fired when he just updates people on the timeline of the accusations, some of the reporting that's been done around it. Mm-hmm. He gives the Biden campaign's response. But even that, simply for bringing it up, has been met with calls for him to lose his job at MSNBC.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote something about this for the Daily Beast and immediately turned off replies, because it's sort of like a hornet's nest that whenever you talk about it, it's like sticking your hand in a hornet's nest, just even acknowledging it. I'm going to vote for Joe Biden in November, but I take seriously when women make accusations of sexual misconduct against men, powerful men, even powerful men that I like. And it, as Chris Hayes said, you know, even though it is hard to come to face to face with really uncomfortable truths or really uncomfortable accusations, we have to, if we're going to be morally consistent, we have to acknowledge when these things come up. I think that the calls for him to be fired are coming from a public that has had relentless bad news for 2 months. And I think emotions are running high right now. People are a little frayed. And so when any really extreme emotional reaction to a news story, I can just kind of chalk up partially to the fact that we're in a really bad situation, and we wouldn't be in this situation, arguably, if we had different leadership. And anything that endangers or appears to endanger that change in leadership really makes people nervous. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that anybody was on the fence about voting for Biden and this one thing is going to make them go to vote for a man who's been accused of sexual misconduct, including rape, by, I think, 17 women. Nobody's going to jump to Trump because of this. You know, this might be a disappointing story, a confusing story. And, you know, I'm not saying that it's true or not true, because reporting is still happening on it and we're still learning more about it. But I think the really extreme reaction to it is because our terrible leadership right now, the Trump administration, is what brought us here. And people really, really believe that the only hope for America's future is to get us out of here, and that Biden is that. So yeah. I think that's what's going on, just in terms of the way that people are processing media. But I think calling for people to get fired because they talk about a story that you don't like is not a really good way to be taken seriously as a media critic.
Yeah, and I assume he's probably going to be okay. You know, I don't think he should be fired. Just want to put that out there. I think he deserves credit for talking about this when most of the other hosts won't. Also, I would say that if you are one of the people on the left who is now giving him credit for this, he's done other good stuff too. I've occasionally given him praise for his coverage of the conflict in Yemen, his continued coverage on climate change, a number of different things. I don't watch his show regularly. I don't necessarily think that he's necessarily the best advocate for these things in terms of style, but he does seem to come from a good perspective. He's not the same as all of the hosts on CNN or anything like that. So I think that this is just the latest in a number of times that he deserves credit for being willing to say things that aren't necessarily sort of the running strategy at MSNBC on any given week. And so let's not fire Chris Hayes. How about that?
Yes. And I also think that this is a good point to say that, you know, we're in an age where we're giving each other bad faith reads a lot of times. Like, we interpret things that people say as having the worst possible motivations. And that's just like it's not a good way to live. I mean, if somebody is ostensibly on your side, I think it's good to give them the benefit of the doubt and assume that what they're trying to do isn't something destructive before you assume that it is something destructive.
Yeah.
Just as a general way of going about life, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And look, I sort of agree with you. I think that the reaction against him is people thinking, if I take this seriously, in fact, if I'm even exposed to information about it, well, then clearly that means that we just have to have more Trump. And I think that you're demonstrating that that does not necessarily follow. That's not what it represents. What needs to happen is the allegations need to be heard. I would like to have a response from Joe Biden. I mean, we should point out that Biden has conducted dozens of national and local interviews in recent weeks, but has yet to even be asked about the allegations. His campaign denied the allegations in a statement on March 28th, and surrogates for the Biden campaign have been asked about it, but he has not. Do I know exactly what would need to be done for most Americans to be comfortable about this story and feel that justice had been served? I do not. But I know that the ground floor is him being asked about it. That seems like, and by the way, that doesn't mean that everything that's been said is necessarily true. We don't know. It's complicated. But he definitely has to be asked about it. I think that that is sort of the minimum.
Right. I also want to say, I think a lot of media figures on the left have seen what happens when anybody brings this up in any way. And it's like sticking your hand in a hornet's nest.
Yeah.
You know, it's easier to just not just stay 10 feet away from it. Even if it is an important story, the easier path is to just stay away from something that is going to, no matter what you say, make people furious. But the courageous thing to do and the right thing to do, if you are somebody who's in the business of truth, is to tell the truth and to try to get to the truth if you don't have the entire truth. So I think, like, trying to give a good faith read to the left-wing media, I don't think it's a conspiracy to protect Joe Biden. I think that it is a fear of any backlash for whatever it is that you say about this story, because people are really tired of the Trump administration, rightfully so, and they really want somebody else to be the president, and they really don't want anything to endanger that. So that's what it seems like is going on to me.
Yeah, potentially. Well, we'll see. I mean, he covered it. He's getting some praise. He's getting some attacks. We'll see if perhaps he'll interview her, or will other hosts start to, because he's sort of stuck his hand in that hornet's nest first. If he survives, perhaps they'll feel freed up to do it. I honestly don't know, but we will be watching and we'll see. Just because America is in the grip of a pandemic doesn't mean that our relationships with other countries aren't continuing, that foreign policy doesn't roll on, and that the stance that our government has towards other foreign governments doesn't necessarily interact with the pandemic in a way that might be devastating for those countries and potentially for other countries as well. And joining us now to break down some of his recent reporting on this, the relationship between the U.S. And Iran and some of the consequences of it, we have once again Ken Klippenstein, reporter for The Nation, joining us on the show. Ken, welcome back.
Great to be with you as always, Chum.
Always glad to have you here. And you had an article recently that talked about some information that's been leaked that has to do with the spread of coronavirus cases that appears to be linked to Iran, which is currently suffering from a number of different U.S.-based sanctions, correct?
Yeah, so this was an internal intelligence assessment conducted by the Air Force, which found that the coronavirus, which is just ripping through Iran, you know, in much the same fashion that it is the United States, you know, more so than our neighbors, Canada and Mexico, although, of course, you won't hear that from the president. It's sort of harming Iran worse than, you know, a lot of its regional neighbors. And the effect of that, in addition, of course, to the suffering of the Iranian civilians themselves, is going to be to spread to a nearby military base, which is our biggest base in the entire Middle East and the whole region, huge base in Qatar. And this assessment found that most of the cases that exist in Qatar now are attributable to Iran, because Iranian nationals travel a lot. You know, they conduct trade, particularly with Qatar, where this huge military base is. So the assessment found that not only is this, you know, a major risk to their own people, which, you know, has humanitarian implications if you care about humans, but also to American soldiers if you don't care about Iranians, as I hope people do.
Exactly. And the official stance of the damage report is that we do care about humans. So so you say in the article that they at that point had cited 800 cases, but we don't know for sure exactly what percentage of those are U.S. service members. But that also was several weeks ago. And so for all we know, the number of cases could be much higher.
Oh, yeah. The number of cases is undoubtedly far higher. And in addition to that, although Iran has the most cases in the region, Qatar has close to the second most. I believe they were third at the point of that assessment. So this is a major threat to, again, our biggest military base in the region. And then when you have soldiers in close quarters, the way that they are trained and they conduct exercises and just go about their day, these are very close quarters. And there's been a great deal of good reporting to this effect, showing that coronavirus poses a particular threat to them beyond what it does to everyone else in many other industries at work.
And so we're going to talk about some of the implications, but part of the implications are based on how bad the situation with coronavirus is in Iran. And we know that even with the numbers that we have, it looks really bad, that they're, you know, one of the countries in the world that has the most cases. It's like 97,000 or something like that. But we don't know for sure, but my gut says that seems like a very low estimate, that for a country that has more than 80 million individuals, that has been described from the beginning as very ill-equipped to deal with this, the idea that they're getting like 1,000, 1,500 new cases a day, that seems like it's probably not a wholly accurate number.
Yeah, there are two issues here that could obfuscate the number. One is there's no incentive for any country, and we've seen this with ours, in President Trump's attempts to downplay the dangers. From the perspective of, you know, state leadership, they're going to want to downplay this because it's going to scare investors, it's going to scare the public. And of course, Iran is an authoritarian country. Let's be clear about that. When I say country, I mean the government, the leadership. I think the civilian population probably has a much different attitude about their leadership, as do many of us. But so that authoritarian character can lead to them, you know, hiding things. And in addition to that, it's just hard to know how many there are to begin with, because we don't even know how many there are in the U.S. There are a lot of, intimations, I think, that the numbers are actually a lot higher because we have an inadequate medical system to actually judge these things, not to mention we don't have enough tests to even look at it. Yeah. So I don't think there is any way that they could know how many there are, in addition to the, incentives to hide and cover things up.
And the idea seems to be that while they might have been ill-equipped on their own in any case to deal with it and to limit the number of cases, both for their own civilians, but also that seems to be emanating out from the country, the sanctions certainly don't seem to be helping. And in the article that you wrote, it talks about how supposedly Pompeo has made overtures of potential help, but we don't know if there are any concrete details. There don't appear to be concrete details. And it doesn't seem like the overall stance of our government under Donald Trump is going to change drastically. I mean, he has been incredibly aggressive towards Iran for some time. His base seems to like that.
Yeah, I think it was kind of a sleight of hand, unfortunately, because I have seen, you know, a lot of reporting saying Pompeo, you know, offers help to Iranians. Iranians don't accept it. And so I'm thinking, oh, that looks bad. And I'm thinking to myself, like, well, why would they want to accept free help if it was offered to them? So I look into it. And I had to really dig to find, you know, what this offer of help was. And what it appears to be is, a purely symbolic overture, which is not nothing. I do think it's important to, you know, try to maintain some kind of diplomatic openness with a country, with any country, including this one. But still in place were a number of preconditions that Pompeo had set forth about a year and a half ago, I believe. And, Obama administration officials have described these preconditions as basically, you know, precluding any sort of reasonable agreement. They're saying there's, it almost seems as though the preconditions Pompeo set in for a, you know, for help are designed to make it impossible for us to ever negotiate with them.
Yeah.
So it seems sort of dishonest.
Yeah, there was one other thing. Maybe this is just a small detail. Feel free to correct us. But our team noticed that one of the quotes that you pull from the document that was provided, this intel brief, it says specifically, Pompeo said that the U.S. offered help and Iran refused. When it sounds like in an intel brief, it would say Pompeo offered help and Iran refused. They're quoting it as if the intel brief itself doesn't want to state it as a fact.
Yeah, you're very astute to notice that. There is a tendency on the part of the military to, you know, it's sort of scary, but there's, when I was a kid, you know, I'd watch Bourne Identity movies, think, oh, they've got all this great intelligence. They don't have any. In many cases, they're just relying on what they see in the press as much as us. And I spend all sorts of time going over declassified documents via FOIA, you know, things that are leaked to me. What I see again and again is more often than not, they're sort of trying to dig through the noise to find out what's going on as much as a lot of folks in the public are. So there may have been genuine confusion on their part about what the overture was, if there was any.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you grew up thinking they've got Matt Damon, but no, he's acting. He's not actually helping him out. And really fast, I want to be clear. I want to give the credit for that notice to our producer, Angel. She was quite astute to have noticed it. But anyway, it seems like long term, if help isn't offered by the United States, if Iran continues to flounder in their response to coronavirus, that's not only going to reap an obvious toll on the civilian population there, but could continue to endanger military personnel in the region, which sounds like something we'd want to avoid. Is there any reason to believe that potentially other countries might step in and fill the void?
I believe that there's a great deal of pressure coming right now from Europe in particular, which also is no, you know, enthusiast for the Iranian regime, but is a little more sensible in terms of understanding that with a pandemic, it's really hard to have an approach to it that is sort of, you know, nativist and, you know, we're going to ignore what happens to other countries. We're only going to focus here because diseases spread. It would seem to be very obvious, almost axiomatic. But when you have an America first, so-called policy that doesn't, you know, address not just the Iranian issue, but also the Chinese issue with one of diplomacy. And this is a problem described to me by an Obama official at the State Department, who I quoted in the story, but you don't have those open lines of communication, that's going to end up exacerbating the problems and the secrecy that exist, you know, in an illness in other states, and that will come back to get us because it's going to spread here.
100%. Really appreciated the article. If anyone watching this would like to read the full article, it's available over at The Nation. The title is How Trump's Foreign Policy Puts Troops at Risk of COVID-19. And you can see all of Ken's other great reporting there. As always, Ken, thank you so much.
Good to talk to you, John.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.